That's the only thing I could guess. Arbuck doesn't give any optional forms on those, does it?
And every single third-person plural has that short form.
That's interesting. I think what you have to do is check the concordance and see if... Same thing with the contract verbs. Okay. It looks like it's just an optional shortened form, and the question in my mind is which one's used more frequently in the New Testament. And I don't know, just have to do some footwork to find out. The analytical probably will list both of them. You should check them and see if both are listed in the analytical. But I haven't noticed that. I probably have noticed it, maybe seeing it in the text or something, and never noticed that it was a short form or something. But that's the only form he puts in his paradigm. That's interesting.
Well, no, it lists them both.
Oh, it lists them both. Oh, okay.
On the third person plural, it always had two.
Oh, I see. Okay. He lists the form that we had in this book first and then that one. Okay. Yeah, in that case, I'm sure it's just a shorter form, an optional form. The question would be how often is it used? And you just have to track it down. Apparently, it's used enough in the New Testament to warrant putting it in the paradigm. But it's probably not used a whole lot. Otherwise, Gesher would make some mention of it, so you would have had some contact with it. Okay, I've got an announcement here. Next Wednesday, the day of our quiz, they're going to move us from this room to room 602. So if I happen to forget, I'll keep this note in my book and so forth. So the reason is that they want to bring the Greek and Hebrew orientation class, need the chapel class, I guess, to finish up. And they need this room because they need all the books back here. So 602 is just across the way here, isn't it? 604 is the big one over there, so 602 is one of these little ones over here, I think. Yeah, one of the Christian school rooms. So that's what we'll be for our quiz. And I don't know if they're going to set up tape in there or not. I assume they are.
Yeah.
Okay. So, be reminded of that. Yeah, right. Hope you're that important that day. Well, to review for that quiz, there's not too much. I told you pretty much what's on it. I think just a quick look here. Chapter 45.
We need to mark for both days today on the table.
Did we forget it yesterday? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Make sure it's up to date. I'm sorry, I forgot. Probably forgot it yesterday. The main thing in chapter 45 that's going to be on the quiz is the recognition of these conditional clauses. So let's take a look at section 351 here, dealing with the uses of the subjunctive and relative clauses and so forth. And these types of conditional clauses are categorized according to the kind of structure that you see both in the condition and the conclusion, and then also with regard to the meanings that are transmitted by that. And so we see in section 351, conditional sentences in Greek may be most conveniently classified according to the form of their constituent clauses. There's type A, which has the particle A with a verb in the indicative in any tense, and if there's a negative, it's usually U, which is more normal for the indicative. The conclusion will be a clause with a verb in the indicative, imperative, or subjunctive in one of its independent uses. In other words, the four uses discussed in those sections earlier. And then type B will be an with a verb in the subjunctive. If there's a negative, it's usually may. And the conclusion would be also either indicative, imperative, or subjunctive. In other words, almost anything for the conclusion. So between type A and type B, the main thing that's determining the difference is what's in the condition. Type A has indicative, and type B has subjunctive. Okay, then type C is A with a verb in the past tense of the indicative. That's a little bit more restricted. It's indicative, but it's past tense indicative. And the conclusion is a clause with a verb in the past tense of the indicative. And with a particle on. Okay, so, and the negative is usually may, though, in this type C, even though it's indicative. Now, what's the significance of these types of clauses? Well, the next few sections involve that. He does make a remark about other conditions, other types of conditional sentences involve the optative mood, these which are not frequently found in dismal to be taken up in lesson 50, so we tacked on a few things about that in lesson 50. But section 352, 353, 354 will give some more information about how these types of conditional clauses are used. Type A, section 352, conditional clauses of type A express conditions which are believed by the speaker to be actual or impossible, or possible, actual or possible. So they're believed to be actual or possible, and there, of course, type A is using A with a verb in the indicative, and the conclusion can be, excuse me, either indicative, imperative, or subjunctive. So, a few examples. If you're led by the Spirit, you're not under the law. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you. If I shall also be offended in you, I shall never be offended. These are all expressing conditions which are believed to be actual or possible. So, if you are led by the Spirit, that's either actual or possible. If they persecuted me, that's an actual situation, of course. If I shall be offended in all, that's a possible situation since it's dealing with the future. And why are you baptizing if you are not the Christ? There is a factual situation again. Now, in contrast to that, conditional clauses of type B express conditions which are believed by the speaker to be generally true in the present or probably realizable in the future. So we've gotten a little bit less certain here with type B than type A. And future conditions are more often expressed by clauses of type B than clauses of type A, although type A will do that sometimes. So remember, your type B is using subjunctive in the condition as opposed to indicative, and the conclusion may be any of those. And that, of course, using the use of the subjunctive itself can tell you that you're dealing with a little bit more hypothetical basis. Not necessarily as uncertain as we see in type C, but it's kind of between type A and type C as far as the degree of certainty is concerned. So, Ion Theles, if you wish, you know, you can cleanse me. But I shall come to you swiftly if the Lord wills. Again, it's the speaker's perception of the situation is such that there's less certainty. It's not something that he believes to be true, to be actual, or possible necessarily, but he believes it to be generally true or probably realizable. And so any of these, if the Lord wills, if you do not wash, you have no part with me. That's a situation, again, in which the speaker is considering that to be generally true. Now, it's going to be a little bit tough to discern between these two, except for the type A and type B. The way you're going to primarily tell is the use of the subjunctive versus indicative in the condition. And if you're composing Greek, of course, this becomes more difficult. It depends on how strong you want to put it. Fortunately, we're reading Greek, so it's already there for us, and we can decide by just looking at the forms whether it's type A or type B. Yes, Mark?
Now, with type B, it says generally true in the present or probably realizable in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So in type A, since he's saying that this is actual, something that's going on right now, the possibility is not something that's remote.
No, it wouldn't be a remote possibility. It's believed to be actual or possible, and possible in a more immediate sense, too. I mean, once you get in the realm of possibility, you get in the realm of degrees. But I would say a higher probability, something that's either actually a fact, and it's a condition upon which something else is being predicted, or it's something that's, imminently possible, you might say. And then the type B is more of a realizable, but not necessarily believed to be the case right at the present time. Or it's considered to be generally true in the present, a general maxim or something like that, a generally true statement. Usually the type A's are dealing with more specific situations, and type B gets into more general. You know, you keep generalizing. And then type C is just hypothetical. So it's not even offered as the reality. Okay. Section 354, the type C clause, express hypothetical conditions. That is, conditions which the speaker himself believes to be contrary to fact. In other words, he's setting up a hypothetical situation because that situation doesn't exist, and in fact. And so he's setting this up, and if the Lord had not shortened the days, all flesh would have been saved, would not have been saved, and so forth. Usually you're dealing with things that are contrary to fact, or considering what would have happened had this not happened, or what would have happened had this happened when it didn't, that type of thing. If God were your father, you would have loved me. And but the point is, he isn't your father, you know, because that's been proven by the fact that you don't love me. Okay. And in the conclusion, you very often see the particle on in the conclusion. So that's another thing to watch for. It's not always there. Occasionally it's omitted here. But you look for the context, the presence of may in the conditional clause or something, and that'll help settle it. But on the test, I'll put an on in there so you don't have to make any guessing on that. So watch for your type C. The critical thing is going to be past tense of the indicative in the condition, and then past tense in the conclusion with the indicative and with the particle on. So type C is indicative in both, past tense of indicative in both, on both sides. Type A and type B can be almost anything on the conclusion side. Okay, that's about as detailed as we're going to go. I'm just going to give you a few sentences to translate and have you identify whether the type A, type B, or type C, and I'll make them indicative enough where it won't be guessing, you know, flipping a coin to see whether it's A or B or something. Yeah, and translating them, and also involved will be some of these compound verbs of luo. I'll use those verbs in the translation so you can pick those up as well. And that was the next chapter, 46. The thing that I want you to focus on for right now is the compound forms of luo that you see on page 279 there, starting with ana luo down to para luo here, those seven forms, whatever it is. You should be prepared to recognize those and recognize them in the aorist and so forth, when the forms that have the augment, what happens to them with the augment. Of course, the trick on those is the augment comes in between. It doesn't come out at the beginning of the word. So that's the main thing as far as recognition is concerned. If you look at page 280 there, you can see for ana luo, the paradigm here. You've got ana luo in the present, ana luso in the future, aneluon in the aorist, or in the imperfect, excuse me. In the imperfect, you've got aneluon. The augment comes between there, and the aorist active is anelusa. Yes? Which ones now? Yeah, you should know what happens to the augment on those for these seven verbs anyway. And so that let's see. How far we want to go with this? Yes, you should be familiar with these seven verbs and what they do there. It's basically all the same. They're just going to get epsilon there. And let me check again here. Might be some question with ek, but that gets exa. In other words, it becomes. They don't have a real simple chart here for you. I was hoping they did. Okay. The only one you might have any problem with be ek luomai here, and the augment on that, you're going to get exa. Exceluon, something like that. Whatever forms are appropriate there, it's deponent too. But the rest would be epeluo, you know, kateluo, kateluon, pareluon, dieluon, etc. Yes, Mark?
I think you answered. Epi turns to
Epa? Yeah, epa. You put the Iota turn left into an epsilon, and the kate, pare, so forth, all of those. That other vowel turns to an epsilon, if you want to think of it that way. Probably the better way to think of it is that the last vowel is chopped off and the augment's put in. That's probably a better way to think of it. Then you don't have to worry about contractions or anything. Oh, yes, okay. There was the chart I was looking for.
Verse 2 and 3 are the significant ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, X is going to change to X. That's pretty much the principle. Before vowels with smooth breathing, if you look at that list before vowels with smooth breathing, that'll give you what they change to, because the augment is a vowel with smooth breathing. So ana becomes an, and then you put a, ana. Anti becomes ant, and then the epsilon. Apo becomes ap plus the epsilon. Dia becomes d plus the epsilon, so it'd be dia. Ek becomes x plus the epsilon, xa. Epi becomes F plus the epsilon, kata becomes kat plus the epsilon, etc. So if you look at that chart, that'll do it for you. Okay. So it'll only be those forms of luo, though, that I'll be having you recognize. And we'll give you some mercy on these root aorists, just because you can just consider those as just plain irregular, and this is more just for observation. And recognizing some of these categories, but those are not worth taking the time to memorize. Perfect and pluperfect, of course, I told you what you'd be responsible for there. On pages 291 and 292, there's the paradigm for those. And just be familiar with luo in the perfect and the pluperfect, and you have the whole paradigm there. Also note the infinitive for the perfect active infinitive, perfect active participle, and the perfect middle and passive infinitives and participles as well. So that's just plain memorization. Now on the test, you can choose yourself whether you want to put the augment on the pluperfects or not. You may want to elect to do it just like they've done it here with the parentheses. And when I put the forms in for you to identify, that's probably what I'll do. Okay, that's about the size of it. These indefinite pronouns and adjectives and adverbs and so forth, those are all pretty straightforward. It's mostly vocabulary, actually, there, with alelon and so forth. And I don't think we're going to be having much of that on the test. Vocative and the other uses of the cases, I'm not going to emphasize right now, because in Dana and Matthew we're going to go into a lot more detail on the use of the cases. So we'll go much more detail than is presented here. And then the optative mood, be familiar with forms of luo in the optative. So page 310, the paradigm there in section 383. You only have present active, present middle and passive, and then the aorist active, middle and passive forms to consider, to worry about. And they're real easy to identify, but for this quiz you need to be able to form them too, just for luo. So this, as far as those verb forms will be concerned, it'll be just like that last quiz we had. I'll give you some of them I'll give you in Greek, and you give me the English, parse it in English, person, number, case, person, number, mood, and so forth. If it's a participle, I'll have to set up something else for that. But and then vice versa, I'll give you the parsing, and you give me the verb form. Okay, so that'll be next Wednesday.
You said you weren't going to have to know any reflexive.
Well, not for this quiz anyway. I think it's mostly vocabulary, and I think you're all familiar enough with them to recognize them. So I'm trying to turn the quiz down, so we'll not worry about those on this quiz. Certainly wouldn't hurt you to review it anyway, but I'm just trying to be nice to you. Let you know what's going to happen. Main thing is I just want you to recognize those clauses. That's probably one of the harder things as far as the grammar is concerned. Okay, that'll be next Wednesday. Let's take a look at our John 1 again.
We're translating today then, the rest of the time.
Next week maybe we'll get initiated into Dean and Red a little bit. Okay. John chapter 1 and around verse 39. I think we did verse 39. We're up to verse 40. We're making more progress per hour now that we got out of the prologue. Yeah. Things tend to be easier when they're just historical narrative. That's one of the easiest things to read. Okay, does anybody remember where we left off? Okay, do you want to do verse 40 then, Glenn? Okay.
Andreas.
Mm-hmm.
That's
the
English.
Andrew, I suppose.
Andrew.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew, you know, German friend of mine.
Yeah, right.
And, the brother, of Simon Peter.
Right. Kind of a string of gems.
The hearing ones, I would say.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. You might say having heard ones, maybe.
Yeah, the having
ones heard. Having heard. Yeah. One of the two of the ones having heard, maybe.
One of the two. Oh, good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, you'll take that one.
With John.
Mm-hmm.
And we went through that verse before.
Yeah.
To follow.
Yes, right.
And having followed one.
Right.
To him.
Mm-hmm.
Was.
Yeah, right, was. Okay, I was hoping you could get the was in there.
I don't know what to do with it.
Yeah. Yeah, it is kind of hard to know where to put that was in there. I think you probably want to put it between Andrew and was. So Andrew was one. In other words, say, Andrew, the brother of Simon Peter, was one out of the two of the ones having heard beside John and having followed him.
It seemed to me like he was getting at, he was saying Andrew, the brother of Simon Peter, one of the two,
mm-hmm.
Having heard was something else that hasn't been mentioned.
Yeah, the problem is that the next sentence doesn't pick up on it. So you just start out with another verb and another independent clause.
That's a comma. With a dot there, that's a minor...
I'll have to check to see if there's a difference in these texts on it. Yeah, after auto is a period.
That's a raised period, though. I thought that was a minor break. Or I like that.
Oh, semicolon. Capitalize the epsilon.
Yeah, it would be like a semicolon, right. But you're still separating the sentence when you do that, separating the clauses.
So how do I know where to put was? Why does it have to be...
I know what you're saying.
In opposition to mm-hmm. Andrew, the brother Simon Peter.
You could easily have it that way. You see, the whole thing could be treated just as the subject, and then following on, if you had no other verb, and so forth, and it was something else, and something, say verse 41 started off with another thing in the nominative or something, that was equating what that was, then you probably would translate it that way. The trouble is that verse 41 starts off with another third-person verb form. Which indicates that you're starting another clause since you already have a third-person verb form in ain. So you'll have to take ain as a predication for Andrew was... Andrew, the brother of Simon Peter, was one of these two. And then verse 41 starts off with another clause. It's only because of verse 41. You get some ambiguity sometimes. You have to keep reading, finding out where... No, you can get by. You could even get by without it. It could be understood just because of predicate construction. Except that with a predicate construction, you don't have the tense value involved. And if you want to specify the tense, especially if it's past tense, you'll tend to see the verb to be in there if it's past tense, and you want to specify that. In other words, if you take the ain out of there, then you'd probably have something like, and Andrew, the brother of Simon Peter, is one of the two, you know, one out of the two. And if you want to make it past tense, then you put ain in there. That's the reason it's in there. Okay? But you can get by with a predicate construction without, but if you want to specify it's past tense, then you put the verb in there. The same thing happens in Hebrew. Okay. Any other questions on those participles or anything? Note that akoluthaison tone is actually an active participle. That theta, eta, sigma is just as a result of other things besides future passive or anything. Okay. Then verse 41, Mark.
Kyriske hutos proton ton alophon ton ideon simona kai lege auto kyrekamen ton nesit'an ho estin meterme mu omenon.
Good.
He finds, or this one finds the first, his own brother Simon, and says to him, "We found the Messiah," which is having been interpreted Christ.
Yes. Okay. Which is having been interpreted Christ. Good. All right, yeah, this one first, this one is finding first, and that first proton is just that one of the cases of an accusative that's got this adverbial sense. He's finding first. He's finding first the brother. It's a little bit ambiguous because of the fact that you have tronad alphon as accusative also. So, it would either be the first brother. But the trouble there is that it's in a predicate position if you do that, so it doesn't really fit. So we have to take this thing as one of those adverbial accusatives. First is often, finds first or second, and that those are often seen that way. So he finds first the brother of Simon and says to him, "We have found the Messiah." And of course, Eureka men, if you've heard the phrase, "Eureka, I have found it." And then ho estin, which is being interpreted, Christos, or has been interpreted, yes?
I was just looking at, I wanted to just make sure Christos is a nominative, because it's being equated to ho in the
right.
What do you call it? The
relative pronoun, ho.
Yeah, the clause of the relative pronoun.
Yeah, yeah. And this estin there, you've got using a participle there, and then the verb to be, estin, so you kind of take this whole thing and then the ho is a neuter, which is being interpreted Christos, so you've got a neuter and then masculine in opposition to each other, as it were, or being equated. And the reason it's neuter is because it's emphasizing the name rather than the person.
It looks like masculine accusative.
Let's see. No, I'm talking about the ho there.
Oh, ho.
The ho. The meter. I'm checking on this other one here. I guess. Okay, that's a nominative singular neuter participle also. So the participle's neuter, and the relative pronoun's neuter. And then Christos, of course, is masculine.
Is that right? Because Messiah is neuter?
No, Messiah is also masculine, but it's not really looking at the person of the thing, though. See, it's kind of describing it. This is kind of an interesting construction. Let me just check on Messiah, though, first. I don't list that here. On Messiah, that should be masculine. Okay, what's happening here is that they're looking at the word Messiah rather than the person Messiah. So focusing on the word Messiah, which just the whole concept, it's not really equating things in a direct grammatical way. It's just which is being interpreted, Christ. And it's putting it in the neuter because you're dealing with the word and the word Messiah, not with the person. So everything's neuter there, except for, of course, Christos. So that would be the reason there. Yes?
My paradigm says that men and women only can be either nominative, neuter, or, accusative. So I was looking at that as accusative masculine, equating that to Christos. A whole S in Christos, metro menomino, which would be making, having been.
I'm not sure if your construction will work, though, there, to make that an accusative, to make it a direct object. You don't have any verb. The only verb you have is an equative verb there, estin, and that's going to take a nominative.
Yeah, they say, which is the Christ, which was having been accused.
Oh, okay.
You can't really have an accusative with this way.
No, it just won't work. It just won't work in a... either an appositional structure like that, or you have to have some sort of a transitive verb involved in order to get that into a position of an accusative like that. So that's the reason why they're calling it neuter, is because it's being equated with the whole there. And it could be nominative, could be accusative, but it would have to be nominative neuter here, just to fit the structure. Yes.
Yeah, I noticed that you're translating that as past tense, almost like a perfect state. Isn't that a present?
Of course, you met there.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a present passive. Yeah, you're right. It's a present passive participle. So which is interpreted? Yeah, that's a good point. It should be which is interpreted, or which is called, which is interpreted, the is coming from the passive, not coming from a perfect idea. Okay, that's a good point. Yeah, which is interpreted Christ. Okay, or which is translated Christ. That methermenuo has more got the idea of translating, carrying it from one to the other. So one language to another. All right. That's an interesting construction, though. The fact that you see the neuter being equated with tone, the see on there, is talking about the word rather than the person. Mm-hmm.
Does that estimate make it more progressive than
being? In a way, yeah, it does, because you use the verb to be with the participle gives you more progressive action. And so, in other words, it's commonly understood that, see, and they're speaking the Greek language at that time, by and large among the Jews, and so it's continually, recognized that this is equivalent to the Messiah. Okay. Verse 42, then, and Dale, I think you're up next.
Egegenin auton proton jeson emblatsa auto ho jesus etem du e demon ho kios iwanu du klaithen se kephas ho in main unit and main nuetai
the hermeneutai okay.
He came toward Christ or Jesus?
Yes. This is from ago, to lead. So, he led him toward Jesus. In other words, it's Andrew leading Peter toward Jesus.
Jesus said to him?
Okay, well, having looked upon him, and bless us, yeah, having looked, to look upon someone or to look into someone is kind of it's from N and Blepo.
Kind of look straight at.
Yeah, look straight at, you kind of peer into, kind of pierced him with his eyes, kind of thing. Okay, so he looked into him, as it were. So having looked into him, with aorist participle, having looked into him, Jesus said. Having looked at him, Jesus said.
You are Simon, son of John.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what place they...
Okay. Okay, this is from Kaleo, and this is a future passive. Future passive. You will be called.
You will be called Cephas. Being translated Peter?
Yes. Yeah, which is being translated Peter. Again, the same kind of construction with ho. There's no Eston in this case, but it's which is being called Peter. Yes.
Well, I wanted to ask about that difference, because here we have ho Eston, Christos, and then a participle.
Yeah.
A passive participle.
Mm-hmm.
Here, hermeneutai is
just a finite verb form, yeah.
So what's the difference in how you really translate the idea there? Which is translated or which is translated?
Well, I think it's going to be a little bit difficult in English. You're going to see methermeneuetai and hermeneuetai. This is just a shorter form, and you might just... I'm not sure how the English translations... You might study a number of them to see what kind of distinction they make in there. But you might say the last one interpreted, and I think what a lot of them do is the first one translated and the last one interpreted, which is interpreted. But I've seen it both ways. Here in the interlinear, they've got translated for both of them. You know, they translate both exactly the same. And as far as the structure, is a little bit different, because the Eston with the participle is giving you, which is being translated. The other is which is translated. It's just a little bit less emphasis. It's the present passive participle, so you still get, with the present you can get progressive action, but it's a little more indefinite. You know, the present can be either indefinite or progressive. Whereas that participle construction with the verb to be has very definitely got a progressive action to it. So that's a slightly different emphasis there. I don't know if a big thing could be made of that. It seems that he's just giving the data here, giving some information here, that Cephas means Peter. Whereas before, the Messiah, which is being, you know, interpreted Christ, it's something that's continually going on. In other words, it's something that's part of their whole religious system, as it were, to recognize that the Christ is the Messiah. Whereas this is just a piece of data and information as far as the meaning of a name is given at a point.
This is kind of an interesting point here. Cephas is the Aramaic,
mm-hmm.
right? And it just seems... Would you be able to say from this, perhaps, that... And of course, we believe it anyway, but using this passage, he is speaking Aramaic. And then what he's writing in...
The author is filling in the information for us.
Right.
Yeah. That's a possibility. It could be... Yeah, it could be that he was speaking Greek, perhaps, but that would be a little stranger to word it this way. If he calls him, yeah, because see the this little phrase here is put in parentheses. That's information that the author is adding to let you know what this is about. Mm-hmm. So he's been talking about the Messiah. Andrew was talking about the Messiah, and that's definitely Hebrew or Aramaic. And then it says which is being interpreted Christ. And that gives us information that what it is. So it looks like he was speaking Aramaic. And this would be the natural thing anyway, among the Jews, like this. It'd be most probable that that's what they're speaking. Yes?
I want to ask another question concerning the difference between the two clauses.
Mm-hmm.
It's like what John said yesterday about Methamen and Omen, like being interpreted with
mm-hmm.
the Metah there. It's like, does that give you an indication that he's trying to draw a more intimate connection between the two words, that they're really equated here closely this way, where here the difference between Cephas and Peter is just sort of like, well, this is sort of what it means.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's it does appear more this with the meta in there. You see more of this one-to-one correspondence, or there's a connection between these two words. Whereas the other hermeneuetai is just it can be translated explained. It's more of a broader equivalent in one language to another. In other words, it may not be quite the same precision. Now, I don't think we can demand, though, that in every instance where hermeneuetai is used as opposed to the other, that we can argue that the words involved there are not as closely linked necessarily. But at least the way the author is perceiving it, he's not trying to be as precise. It seems like there's more precision with the meta form. I think what would you have to do to settle that question is do a thorough word study on both of them and see, contrast them and so forth. Anybody who takes meta, that would be a good one to use. So, to see, you know, to try to test and see what mata is doing. Mata is one of the harder prepositions. If anybody wants to take that one, it's one of the harder ones to work with. It's not as easy to analyze as some of the others. So I guess that's all I can say. I haven't done a thorough word study on this, but my impression is over, you know, in the translations and so forth, is that Metta's got more this idea of a translation from one language to the other. And here, Manuatai can be that too, but it may be more broad as far as an interpretation. An interpretation of something isn't always necessarily a translation of it. But that hypothesis would have to be tested by examining all the instances of both. And you'd probably find quite a few of them here in John. So there's something for somebody else to throw into their paper. If you do metta, it'd be really good for you to do this. And I think this would be a good test case, because you will see hermeneuo with and without metta. Okay. Verse 43, then, unless there's another question here. Yes?
I was going to ask about just a quick comment. We talked about leading people to Christ, and it seems like, as I was reading this, hey, God, getting out, so and so, 28,
yes.
He led to Christ,
yeah, and that's biblical language, to lead someone to Christ. That's exactly what he did. He led him right to Christ. That's real good. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
On the morrow, he wished to come out into Galilee, and find, and he, I guess it's a historical past.
Yeah, right. It's a present form, but, yeah.
Right, I mean, historical present.
Yeah.
He found Philip, and he said to him, and Jesus said to him, follow me.
Okay, good. Yeah, on the morrow, or through the morrow, he will to go out, and here's your... Remember, fellow is often one of those verbs that's used with infinitives. So here's an infinitive construction with the form of fellow. So ephelesen, aethelthein, aethein galileon. And he finds Philip, literally, and you know, but it's projecting you back there. So you might translate, he found Philip, and I think that's what a lot of the translations do with it. And says to him, and Jesus says to him, follow me. Okay. Anybody with questions on that?
Is that the third person for Kulote?
No, this would be an imperative form. And let's see. Yes, it's present singular, active imperative form, second person plural. So he's talking to them. Second person singular, excuse me. Second person singular. So he's talking to an individual. He's saying, follow me. And it's an imperative form, command.
The contract verb.
Akaluthao is the contract verb, yes. That's what's happening there, is on your ending. Anyone else?
Where do we just say, you said that this is imperative?
Yes. Yeah. Second person singular present active imperative. From Akaluthao, it's a contract verb. So it might be good to look at that paradigm again if somebody's got it handy. The trouble is, in that chapter, they didn't put a paradigm in for you.
Right.
That's why it's good to get. If you don't have a list of complete paradigms, you should procure one of some sort. Dana and Matthew's got a pretty good one, but sometimes it's awkward to fold that thing out of your book all the time. Better to have you have it on separate pages. Let me see if I can find something here to give you the logic behind this. Okay. Yeah, it might be similar to that. You can't trust those me verbs very well, but that's the same ending, and I think it comes out being the same for... it would have been just an epsilon, and because it's a contract verb, you get epsilon, epsilon, and that's going to give you epsilon, iota, in your contraction. But I guess we didn't talk about the contract groups here today. We got the me verbs, we got the opponent verbs. Formation of contract verbs is listed. Okay, that was an exercise you did. I don't know if we did that one or not. 43B. But it'll be epsilon plus epsilon. That gives you epsilon iota. Okay. Always complications. 44. Right.
Poleos, no.
Oh, Poleos. Tais Poleos would be the city.
Oh.
It's from Polis. It's one of those friendly iota stem third declensions.
Okay. A, death, co, flippo,
apo, de, fa. Beth Saida. Okay.
And Philip was from Bethsaida.
Mm-hmm. Bethsaida, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Out of the city of Andrew and Peter.
Right, out of the city of Andrew and Peter. Okay. Good. Remember the genitive forms on those iota stems get that omega. Eos. Okay, any questions besides that? 45, Steve.
Ereske Philippos ton Nathaniel kai lege auto pon egrapsin moj luze ento limo kai hoi sopetai Ureke come in Yesu to your to Yosef Yosef ton Apo Nazareth.
Okay.
Philip. Finds.
Yeah, finds. Philip finds.
Nathaniel says to him, the one whom Moses spoke of.
Or wrote, yeah.
Wrote of.
Yeah, you almost have to say wrote of or something. The one that Moses wrote in the law.
Wrote of in the law.
Mm-hmm.
And the prophets we have found.
Okay, right.
Jesus, son of Joseph, from Nazareth. And what is
it? Jesus, the son of, let's see. Yeah, it's referring to Yesun, Huyun, to Yesuf Ton. This is almost acting like a relative pronoun in a way, but the one from Nazareth, in other words, that article tone is being applied to the prepositional phrase apo Nazareth, and that is functioning like an accusative noun. So we haven't really dealt a lot with the articles using being, you know, in fact we'll see articles on whole clauses or whole phrases sometimes. The from Nazareth one. Mm-hmm. That'd be the way to translate it, the from Nazareth one. Okay, and the bell ring yet? Okay, it hasn't. There's another thing I want to mention here. The Hiereske Philippusun, okay, he says, Hon egrapsen mo useis entonomo kai hoi prophetai. This hoi prophetai is nominative, and what it's really saying, the one whom Moses wrote in the law and the prophets wrote, in effect. In other words, the prophets were all, he's trying to identify the one that both Moses in the law wrote about and the prophets wrote about. Although all it just says is hoi prophetai, and you have to kind of supply the idea that they wrote also. Because it's nominative, it's in parallel with mohuseis there. So the one that Moses in the law wrote in the law and the prophets wrote, as it were, we have found.
In essence, what you're doing is taking that... moving it back before the prepositional phrase.
Yeah, you have to. Otherwise, it would be, see, if it was in the law and the prophets, then hoi prophetai would be dative also.
And when we find, seems they do this, find a compound subject, essentially is what it really is.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the first element of the compound subject that determines
the verb form? Not always. It depends on how it's set up. If you set it up differently, and if you had mo'useis kai hoi prophetai, then you'd see a plural form for the verb. But if they do it this way, where they kind of say Moses and the law wrote, and then you kind of tack on this other thing, and the prophets, and then understanding the rest, then it'll be according to that first one. In other words, you're making one complete sentence, as it were, and then you're sticking on hoi pro phetai and then supplying the rest of it by understanding. But suppose they took, mo'useis kai hoi pro phetai and put that as a compound subject, then you'd see a plural form for the verb. Mm-hmm. But this kind of thing does happen relatively frequently, and you have to get used to it, because in English it sounds pretty choppy.
It's almost like what we might do with putting brackets around it.
Mm-hmm.
Most in the law, brackets and the proper.
Right.
Strange.
Yeah, it is. It is a little bit strange. Okay. I think that's all I wanted to say about that. We've talked about the tone apo nazaret. Just consider apo nazaret as an accusative noun, undeclinable accusative noun. The whole preposition phrase is functioning like a noun, in other words. And we're going to see longer things than that functioning like nouns later on. Yes?
I just wondered if it, I noticed back, I think it was in verse 16 or something, where there was a compound subject and only a singular verb, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You might have mentioned that. I think it was the grace and the truth.
Yeah, we ran across it before. I think it was the same kind of a deal where the subject, they stuck the verb and then they put another portion of it afterwards. Or either that, or sometimes if you've got a neuter plural, you can get a singular verb too. If the things are neuter or if they're inanimate objects sometimes, that'll work too. So I remember running into it. I can't remember what the details were. Was it on that grace and truth? That is a little bit different. It's a similar type of thing, though. What they're kind of specifying to, grace and truth through Jesus Christ, it has come to pass. And what you're really in effect saying is grace has come to pass in Jesus Christ and truth has come to pass in Jesus Christ. In other words, it's kind of particularizing each one of those just by using the singular, kind of, puts the emphasis on each one of them individually. In other words, it's kind of a short way of saying grace has come to pass in Jesus Christ and truth has come to pass in Jesus Christ. So that's kind of interesting, too. Okay. It's either that or you say that John was a poor grammarian and didn't know how to use plural verbs, and that's unlikely. Okay, verse 46. Got enough time to do that? Right. Okay.
And Nathanael said to him, out of Nazareth, can anything good be? And Philip said to him, come and see.
Okay, good. Come and see. And this time the idah is an imperative also. Both of them are imperative. But we had one earlier, was opsis there or something, where you had a future for the second one. Yes?
Do not use that present.
Do not tie? Yes. Let me double check it, though, before I...
Is it
It's present passive, third person singular, from dunamai. This is... Remember, dunamai is one of the oddest verbs. They had to give you the footnote with a paradigm for that one. That's not even a normal me verb. So, yeah, it's a present